You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. From Darwin, Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sambeek. Hello again. Today I'm meeting with Alison Grant. It's a beautiful morning here in Darwin, and Alison is a remote social worker, but she finds herself in Darwin today as she has a week off from her fly-in and fly-out job. Since graduating with a Bachelor of Social Work from the University of Queensland, Alison's worked mostly with children, youth and families in out-of-home care, community development and support services in Brisbane's north. Then, when she arrived in the Northern Territory in 2010, she started out working at both Victoria Daly Shire Council and Worley Health Services. Now, Alison finds herself at the Department of Human Services, a large government agency, flying out of Darwin to remote communities to support vulnerable families that are experiencing financial difficulties, homelessness, or domestic violence, and to reduce some of the barriers that are impacting on school attendance. So welcome to Talk the Walk, Alison. I'm so glad you've joined me today.
Thank you, Lucy.
And I appreciate you getting out a little bit earlier on your Saturday to have a coffee first so we can get to know each other a bit, because this is the first time I've met you.
Yes, it's been interesting.
So I'm wondering if we can begin by just delving a little bit into your history and what it is that brought you to social work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people or communities. Can you give us a bit of context?
Like talking to you earlier, and I told you I'm a migrant, so I've come to Australia from Fiji, and I understood the disenfranchisement, I suppose, with having people speaking several different languages and English not being the primary language. I was lucky in that I knew English, and that was my main language, and I read and wrote in English. And that's something that impacts highly on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, as well as other migrant populations. And it seems that the biggest impact are usually on the women and children struggling just to navigate through their everyday life situations when they have to deal with government agencies and stuff. They have a lot of trouble just in doing things that we take for granted, like filling out forms and writing their names. And that has been a big part of why I've liked being in the Northern Territory and staying here for this length of time, and what keeps me in the Northern Territory, going out to communities and being able to learn and share and experience different cultures.
So it sounds like the language barrier was something that you were really interested in, given your history of coming from a country, Fiji, and coming to Australia. Even though you brought English with you, you had some appreciation for the barriers that people face when English isn't their first language. Would you say that's one of your interests, and that's why you've come to this work?
Yes. Pretty much before I started doing social work, living in interstate, like I said to you, I volunteered at the migrant resource centres, where we had some of the refugees and women who had come over through marriage to Australia, for instance, Filipino women, and English was not a first language, so I did voluntary work there, trying to help them, just filling in forms. They could speak enough English to get by, but they struggled with Centrelink forms.
Yes, as we all do.
Yes.
And so it's a huge, it's much more of a barrier for them. Yeah. So can you speak more about what I guess, is your drive or your passion for working in Indigenous communities, because it's not an easy thing to do and it's not a path that a lot of social workers set out on. What was it for you that drove you or inspired you to do this work?
So my first visit to an Aboriginal community was when I started work for the Shire in Katherine, and that was a huge education for me in understanding and witnessing and being part of their cultural lifestyle that they lead out on the communities, and realizing that there were a lot of similarities with village lifestyle back home in Fiji, and appreciating and increasing my knowledge on the cultural side of things, their taboos and the difference with women's business and men's business, and understanding why they live the way in the communities, how the job share things, the different things, the men go and hunt for bigger animals and the women do hunting as well, but for turtles, and they catch the fish in the rivers. And I was really fascinated by how they read the flora and fauna on the land, and that's how they decide when they're going hunting, what's in season. And I realized that they do that in most Pacific Island countries, but I took it for granted growing up in Fiji, and it wasn't until I got here, went out to community, and the old lady said, okay, we'll go next week and hunt for turtles. And I wanted to know why next week, and they said, oh, because they're watching the color of the flowers, and when different things bloom, that means that the barrow's fat, the turtles have put fat in them, and it's time to catch them. And it was just learning all of that stuff and understanding how they survived in this practically desert landscape for so many years, because most other cultures around the world are subsistence. They lead a subsistence lifestyle, and they have a patch of dirt where they plant, you know, and have animals and stuff. And Aboriginal people never did that. And it was really interesting to learn how they survived. And while they were moving around, they were actually reading the signs of things that flowered to know when, even up to when it was the right time to go and collect mud crabs. That was really interesting.
Right.
And it was just so natural. And
because your work at that time was a very short time limited piece of work, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was around 6 months. So it's a bit of a taster for you of what Katherine life was like.
Yes.
So was it something that you kind of latched onto and thought, oh, I've got to stay here, I've got to learn more?
Yes.
Right. Okay. What happened from that point?
Because I came up and it was a locum position, and I then found out that there was another social work position going at Worley, which was the Aboriginal Health Service in Katherine. And they were looking for a social worker, and the funding for the program that I'd started in was coming to an end. So I applied for that social work position and got given that position and decided I would stay and work at Worley. And again, that was a very interesting learning, because I had no idea how the Aboriginal Health Service worked. It also brought me into very close contact with the Department of Children and Families. They funded that program and the position that I had at Worley, and we looked after, did family support for children in families with failure to thrive and stuff like that. That they got sent to us basically from the Department of Children and Families.
where there were concerns around child protection issues.
Yeah. They were low, they weren't a high priority on their list. However, due to neglect and possibly failure to thrive, they wanted them to have supports put in place to sort of reduce the possibility of them becoming more involved in the child protection system.
So what was a daily life like in that kind of role for you? What sorts of things were you doing?
So in the mornings, most mornings I would do a school run and get children to school. A lot of the mums that I worked with didn't have licenses or access to vehicles, and they were single mums mostly. So I would do a school run, collect children and drop them off at school. And some of my kids had been banned from the school bus. So there was no other way to get them to school but to do a school run. I even visited principal's offices, which was an interesting learning for me. I'd never really had to visit the principal's office with my own kids. And making sure that so during the day I would talk to most of my mums, check if they had appointments for doctors and stuff, because that was part of the deal with the Department of Children and Families. They had to have regular medical checkups. A lot of the kids were on different types of medication. We had children with diabetes and children with that ear, they colloquially refer to it as wet ear, but I don't know what the scientific term is, so I would just make sure that they came in and had their medication and stuff sorted.
So these are kinds of, it's worth pointing out, these are kinds of medical issues that are really only affecting Aboriginal people in communities, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, which are kind of issues that we don't, in our culture, experience.
Yes.
Yeah. So it sounds like it would be quite a busy job there.
Yes.
You're immersed in, yeah.
Yes. So we had 10 families at any given time that we worked with. And
so what sort of results were you getting for those families?
Well, for the majority of times, we kept them from having more involvement with the department. And those were, I always considered that that was a positive. And if they were struggling with anything, they felt very comfortable in calling me, even on the weekends, to tell me, you know, if they had a problem. I built up a good rapport with most of my families, and they would stop me in the street. Catherine's a small town, 15,000 people, if that. So I would bump into them quite regularly, and they would stop and chat to me. And a few of them left the program and moved away, and some of the mums got jobs and stuff, and so they were doing better, and children were a bit older and navigating their way through life. And we had one little girl who was very ill. She started out okay, and they went for a visit to Kununurra for a funeral and came back, and she contracted encephalitis. And that meant that she was high needs disability from then on. But she, one of the reason I talk about her is her parents sort of didn't know how to handle this situation once they had been released from hospital. And I used to visit them regularly and chat to them, because they had to give her meds and they had to have an alarm set to give her medication. And they were going through the motions, but I pointed out to them that she smiled every time either mum or dad came in the room. Mum was becoming quite distant, and she was not handling what had happened very well. But when I said to her, you know, she recognizes you and she smiles when she sees you, because she remembers from before she got sick. you had an attachment and a bond with her. Mum then looked at her and you could see, you know, in her facial expression that she had not thought about that until I pointed it out to her and said, she actually recognizes you and Dad and her brother and smiles whenever you guys come around her and she sees you in her. You know, she might be different, but her brain function is still good that she knows who you are and that you were her primary carer.
So I imagine that was a huge change for that family and shock. What had happened.
So I learned a lot of interesting things.
So tell me about the learnings that you took from your experience in Catherine and now you're in Darwin doing a different role. Can you take us through the transition from Catherine? And you obviously made a decision, I'm going to stay in the territory. What was that about?
So I came to Darwin in at the end of 2012, I think it was, and I started work for the Department of Human Services in 2013. And I applied for the job because it was a remote service position. When I saw that advertised and they said you would be visiting remote communities, I thought this will be very similar to what I was doing in Vic Daily Show with going out to all the different communities in the Victoria Daily Shire area. And I was always interested and I'd watched a lot of documentaries on Arnhem Land and the people and how they survived. And like I said, it's pretty much a desert landscape when it during the dry. It's hard to believe how it changes so dramatically when it rains. And I was quite interested in that, but I didn't want to do that as a tourist. I wanted to learn about the difference in the cultures up here as opposed to down Catherine Way.
So what gave you the confidence to be able to dive in and do that job? Because it's, yeah, it was different to what you had done, but I mean, obviously been exposed to some of the culture and what gave you the confidence that I could really do this?
I suppose the working in Catherine, because when I first got there, it was very daunting. It was, I sort of went, got there and thought, this is huge. This is bigger than one social worker in Worley. Then coming up to Darwin, I thought, I don't know. I didn't have rose-coloured specs on thinking, you know, I'm going to go out there and save the world. It was more about maybe I could be helpful to a couple of people and have some kind of positive impact. It was scary. I did buddy trips the first few times with other social workers who work in the Department of Human Services. We had three or four social workers at that time who identified as Aboriginal and were local, had been to what Northern Territory Uni at that stage, before it became Charles Darwin Uni. And they had to do some of their studies down in Adelaide because we didn't have Bachelor Institute back then.
So how important was it to have those Aboriginal social workers alongside you in the beginning?
It was really good. It was good learning. They were pleased that... So there's quite a few social workers there. Most of us are migrants. And I think being a migrant gives you a hugely different perspective of what the difference and how hard it is for people to navigate through the different systems and the language barriers and all of that. It gives you a better appreciation because you've come here and the struggle is real when you first arrive, the culture shock and everything else. So I think I've met other social workers and I've went to uni with other social workers who came from quite privileged backgrounds in Western society, and I've maintained contact with some of them, and they actually don't understand why I stayed in the NT for this long.
Really?
Yes.
Why is that? Why did they find it difficult that you'd stayed here so long?
Because they preferred the mainstream. Most of them work in schools and Queensland Health.
Okay.
So they like the 8 to 5 work day and the safeness of the environment and having control.
And whereas that contrasts with your work?
I never know from one day to the next what's going to be happening out on a community. Sometimes the community's in crisis, sometimes the youth on the community decide that they're going to run amok and have little riots out in the community, and on any given day we flew into an outstation and we didn't realize, because they're so isolated, that they had an actual funeral on and they had the body in at the outstation. They were starting their funeral service, so we apologized and were prepared to get back on the plane and leave, and they said no, because it was Centrelink were visiting, they needed to get their stuff, some of them needed stuff done because of their isolation and having one payphone that actually worked in the community. There would have been 40 or 50 odd people there in the community, and I think half of them had come because of the funeral, and maybe 10 people actually lived in that outstation.
So what you're describing is really a chaotic kind of world for the social worker, isn't it, out in these remote communities? And some can't hack it. They go back to Queensland to their nice mainstream jobs. What is it that's kept you here? Because it really is challenging sometimes, isn't it?
Yes. I don't really know. It's just something that I just have this thing, this drive in me where I always feel the need to stop and help somebody, even on the weekends or whenever I'll be driving along and I'll see somebody walking and I'll think, where are they walking to at this time of the night, and stop and offer them a lift.
So that's about going the extra mile, really, isn't it? When you want to be part of a community and help a community, it's actually being part of that community.
And I just have always felt that Australia's been good to us. You know, we migrated here and we should give back to the community. I've dragged all three of my children to the blood bank as soon as they were old enough to donate blood. And I've told them that, you know, that's just part and parcel of being in a community, give back to the community. I signed my two younger girls up when they were in high school to do homework with a Sudanese refugee resettled family. Mum and dad didn't speak English and it was very difficult for them, so I got my girls to sit with their two young boys and do homework with them.
So in all aspects of your life, you're kind of giving back to Australia, because they've given, Australians have given so much to you and Australia has given so much to you.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about some of the challenges that you found along the way, whether that's in Catherine or whether that's in your current role, and what are the real struggles?
The challenges for me, I suppose, being a bit of a feminist, have been coming up against patriarchal type policies and systems, and culturally it irks sometimes when I'm out and on a community and I have a lady presenting with obvious, you know, aftermath of domestic violence, and then saying things to you like, oh, you know, that's just how we live. That, like I said, bothers me, that we women are growing up and it's 2017 and they're still thinking that that's
violence is normal.
Yeah. I think there's not enough education happening to sort of change that. I know that federal government has got on board with, you know, domestic violence and everything now, but the biggest thing that impacts a lot of the women out in community is where do they go? You know, if they've come from another community, you can sort of help them get back to their family support system. But if that is their community, then a lot of times that ends up causing rifts between different family groups on the community. And as a foreigner / Western, you know, coming from a Western type background, going out into the community, like I said, it irks and it gets me quite riled up thinking, this is just wrong. Why is this happening? This shouldn't be like this. But then also understanding culture enough and appreciating that these ladies have to live there and I get to go home and I can't upset the balance of whatever it is that's going on for them in their life and then get them riled up or get them agitating for, you know, a feminist cause and then I leave and I go home. I always have to remember that they have to survive as best they can in that situation. I can provide, you know, phone numbers or whatever support I can while I'm there, but I'm not staying there, you know, to help them if things get worse for them and having impacted them so that there's negativity that flows on from my contact with them and understanding that, like I said, I get to leave that community and go home. And that's not my life when I'm not there, so I can't be all radical and, you know.
It kind of reminds me of the principle of do no harm. Could you think of some of the other values or beliefs or principles that I guess are important to you when you come across challenges like that?
Well, I suppose I've just learned to be very mindful and respect others in their difference. One of the Aboriginal social workers that I worked with, we were having a discussion. We did a buddy trip out to one of the communities and we were having a discussion and I said to her that from a feminist perspective, I was very, very put out and it bothered me a lot how everything was patriarchal and people just accepted it and nobody questioned it. And, you know, even to the extent of federal government, you know, it's all very patriarchal and the balance of power and stuff. And she said to me, there are some very strong women in the communities and they do a lot of things behind the scenes and we may not get to see that during our visits or understand that, but we just have to respect that there are women that do things in the background and
challenge the patriarchal kind of view.
And she said, we can only do as much as we can while we're there and we're not going to fix everything. And
so is that one of the frustrations for you, that you're only there for a very small amount of time? Or is that something that's completely accepting and, you know, is part of the job?
Well, it's very strange in the beginning, but because I've been doing this for 4.5 years now, and I've sort of stuck to 4 main communities that I visit. I've built up a lot of connections and, you know, with the other service providers. Like out in community, we have Save the Children, Catholic Care. Sometimes there's Red Cross, the schools, teachers, the nurses in the clinics. So you sort of build up connections with the different service providers because they seem to go to the same communities as well. Even the pilots that fly us out know our name. You know, you don't need a ticket with your name on it because they know who you are. So yeah.
So how is that helpful in the work, having those connections and relationships with other stakeholders out there?
Because they're people that I can refer my families to, and sometimes they're there on the alternate weeks from when I'm there, so we all stay connected via email, and then I just email them and ask them to check on different families or with the school enrollment and attendance measure. I've gotten to know the truancy officers, the teachers, principals, the police, and we sort of all try and work together to put systems in place to support getting children to school on a more regular basis. So that's been a big thing. And having worked in Worley, in Catherine, it was very helpful to me to understand about the ear problems that children have and encouraging mums to take them to get seen to, because that eventually creates, the children eventually get deaf, lose the hearing in one or both ears with, if that's not fixed when they're little.
And I imagine that impacts on children's ability to go to school and stay engaged in school.
Yes.
So it's about the early intervention stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
With health, that's very important.
Yes.
That you've brought to your role now.
Yeah. And talking to parents about the, you know, the need for them to go to the clinic and make sure that their children have all of their medicines and vaccinations and things, because they all live in such close proximity to each other and there's overcrowding. So if one person gets sick, you know, you can wipe out a whole class of kids in one fell swoop with whatever's going around. And there's always problems like scabies, which we don't have, like you pointed out earlier, which is something that we don't even think about in a Western concept or here in Darwin, but it's a huge problem for the children out on community. And just, yeah, general stuff like that. Mothers being very young and not fully understanding the nutritional, the impact that bad nutrition has for little ones and their failure to thrive and stuff like that. And just being very, as a social worker, just always pushing that whenever having contact with young mums and talking to them about making sure that the children are getting proper nutrition and encouraging them to sign up to the school nutrition program so that they're at least getting their two meals every day at school that is follows some kind of nutritional guidelines.
It sounds like your role at the moment is really varied. You can be working with a woman around domestic violence one day or one hour, and the next hour you're rounding kids up for school, and the next hour you're, yeah, you're just doing it all out on communities. Is that what it's like? A bit chaotic? Yes. And
yes, and I think that's one of the reasons why I have stayed in this role for this long, because it's different. No day is ever the same as the previous day.
Yeah. So you like the variety.
Yes.
Top three skills or abilities or knowledge that you've really learned in this time that you've spent in the Northern Territory that perhaps social workers on the Eastern Seaboard wouldn't even have? What do you think those top three skills would be?
Patience.
Yeah?
That's the biggest thing, is patience. Time doesn't really have a meaning.
Yeah.
The morning is the morning. If somebody says, I'll come and see you in the morning, they could reach you at midday. And knowing, I suppose, not having expectations. That was the biggest challenge for me when I first got to Catherine. I would make times to meet people.
Yes.
And they would show up half an hour late. And I was appalled, and nobody sent a message to say I'm running late or anything like that. So, like I said, patience. Learning that, and learning that it has no actual value for anybody in community except for on a Western type agenda. You know, kids need to be at school at 8:30 or what have you, and parents are happy if the children are at school by 9.
So there's a certain amount of just being able to go with that, isn't it?
You have to be flexible.
And that's just the way it is.
Yes, you have to be flexible. You have to have patience, and you have to be respectful. The I found not just Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, all migrant people, they know if you're not being genuine with them. They understand. They may not be able to speak, you know, English as well as you do, but they still, you know, understand if you're trying to help them or... And they, if you're respectful to them, they will be respectful back. You know, they're just beautiful people. Like, I see an elderly lady out in Wadair, and as soon as she sees me or knows that I'm in the community, she'll come and see me every day. And the local staff will growl at her and tell her, no, you can't go, she's busy. And she'll just sit there and wait and say, I'll wait. And so I always just go and talk to her, even if it's for 2 minutes. She's happy with that. And then she goes.
So how do you develop that level of trust and genuineness and openness? How does that come to be? There's obviously some things happening that... What can you pinpoint what those things are that help build a respectful relationship?
For me, one of the things that I've always... maintained when I've been out in communities for the whole of the time that I've been here in the territory is being honest with people. If I can't do something for them, not making promises for stuff, but and always following up. So if I say to somebody, if they've asked me something or they ask me for help, and I say to them, I don't know how that works, but I can find out for you and give you that information, and actually looking for them and following up with them, they appreciate that you've had enough respect for them to not just fob them off, which is something that happens quite regularly for them.
People not following up and following through on things they've promised.
And they're used to people flying in and out of their communities. That's been happening since the intervention happened. So they're quite used to people in authority coming and telling them, you know, you should do X, Y, and Z. And then they don't see them again, or people from Canberra visiting, and so they quickly learn to just go, yep, okay, yes, or nod at you and say yes if you ask questions and stuff. However, once you've developed a rapport with them, or they've figured out that you are have a genuine interest in what's going on for them, then... Like I said, they return that respect and, you know, come back and see you and stuff. And I think it's also, like I said, you know, you make a time or you tell somebody to come and see you and they don't show up. But the next time you see them, you talk to them again and say, I'm still over there, come and see me. And after the third or fourth time, they think, she hasn't really forgotten about me, so I'll go and see her. Persistence.
You haven't nicked off. You haven't gone away. You've stayed there and you've shown that you're going to stick around and follow up with your promises. So what do you think sets social work in Indigenous communities apart from social work in other contexts? What do you think that you think or do differently up here in the Northern Territory that you would be doing in other places?
I think one of the things that I remember learning at uni, they are always promoted having your notebook and your pen with you and taking notes. That doesn't work. I found that a lot of my clients or people that I work with here in the territory become a bit put off if you're writing and scribbling notes down, and especially with the language barrier, they can't read what you've written and stuff like that. You've always got to explain to them. So usually I just dot point things and say, I tell them straight up, I'm just writing your date of birth or whatever, so that, and I ask them to spell their names for me and stuff, because if it's in language, then I've got no hope of doing that later. When I'm doing admin stuff, when I'm back in the office, so I always get them to spell their name for me or stuff like that. And they sort of understand that I'm not really taking notes. I tell them, you know, all your stuff's confidential, etc. And that I just need that for later when I'm actually doing reports and stuff, and they're quite happy with that.
So being really transparent about what notes you're taking, if you have to take any at all.
Yeah.
And that's understandable, isn't it? When there's been a history of, in past policies, taking copious notes on people and writing really inappropriate things in records. And okay, that's really interesting. What else would you say has been some of the big differences of working in this context to other contexts?
So I had, every time we go out to community, we access the Aboriginal Interpreter Service, and they have a lot of interpreters that are out on the communities and stuff like that. And I had never really been in a situation with the cultural poison cousin stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'd heard of it, but hadn't really been impacted by it in my work.
So then, for those that are listening that don't know what that's about, can you explain how the poison cousin thing works in families?
So in different communities, it's different, but it's got to do with the Moiety system. And they refer to people as poison cousins because they're not supposed to be communicating with them. Some of the really strong cultural communities, they don't sit in the same rooms. They talk to each other through a third person. It's very similar in the Western concept to your first cousins. And it was to do with keeping the genetic pull from becoming with the having children and stuff biologically with the same genetic pool, and that's how they controlled that. That's the best that I can understand from the Moiety system. It confuses me.
Don't want to hook up with your first cousin and children, basically.
Culturally, so you're not supposed to even talk to them, and that's what that poison cousin thing is. And it applies to the males and the females. So it's very similar in a lot of Pacific Island cultures, and especially in Fiji. Your mother's sisters are known as your mums, and the Aboriginal people do that as well. Mm. So all mum's sisters become your mums.
Mm.
And I think they also use it with the first cousins on the matriarchal side, the mums, and on the patriarchal side, it's all the brothers and first cousins of dad, their fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And in Fiji, they do that as well. The fathers on all of your father's brothers are your fathers, and all of your mother's sisters are your older or younger mums.
Mm-hmm.
In the indigenous Fijian culture, and that's very similar to how this poison cousin stuff works. So basically, rather than saying poison cousin in Fiji, we say your sister's children would be my siblings. If we had, if your mother, you and my mum were sisters, all of your children would then be classed as my siblings because you were my mum as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how that works, so that they...
I imagine that's really important, having knowledge of the kinship family system in your work. So you know who can talk to who and who can't talk to who. And
Because I'm an outsider, I don't know who the families are and who's connected to who in the community. So I bring, I had a mum in for the school enrollment attendance family conference, and she asked for an interpreter. So I went and got the interpreter and brought the interpreter in. Then he walked in the door and sat down, but turned his back to me and the mum, and then started hyperventilating. And I was looking at him and saying to him, "Are you okay? Do you need to go to the medical centre?" I wasn't sure what was wrong. And then he said, "I can't be here. We're poison cousin." And it was awful for me. I felt so bad because it had such a huge physical impact on him. And because he thought, you know, I'm the social worker, I've come in and blah, 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 he had to come. He didn't feel like he was able to go no, I can't come in that room. Mm. Like, he's my interpreter. He spoke English. He could have just said to me, Alison, I'm not going in that room. That's cultural taboo. Yes.
But thank goodness for body language and you reading body language, hey? Turning the back, seeing him hyperventilate. That was a pretty much a sign saying no.
He went back and apologised to my mum that was in the room.
But hey, you know, this is how we learn, isn't it?
Yes.
We make mistakes, we stuff up, and it's nice to be told and learn from that, isn't it? So I was wondering if we could finish, Alison, on a good news story or one of the sparkling moments that you've had in your work up here and where maybe you had, I don't know, a really good outcome for a family or, I don't know, what would you like to share as your sparkling moment?
There's been a mixture of good and bad, and I suppose for me, every time I do work with a mum, a young mum especially, and help her navigate through the huge lots of paperwork and everything else that happens with getting into Centrelink and registering babies and stuff, those are always positives. They're always small things,
mm-hmm.
but when you add them all together,
mm.
and like that elderly lady, you know, just coming up to me and hugging me whenever she sees me on community,
mm.
just little things like that.
You know, you're special. Doing something right, don't you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. So what does the future hold for you? What sort of things are going to be, yeah, in your neck of the woods in your career over the next little while?
I'm not too sure right now. Probably stay in Darwin for another couple of years and then heading back to Queensland, most likely. That's sort of the plan right now. Nothing concrete. Well, I came to Darwin, came to the Northern Territory on my own for a locum position. And I'm still here 7 years down the track, so...
And the family followed you.
Yes. So, yeah, at least another couple of years in Darwin.
And if people listening want to connect with you, I don't know, either online or in person, how can they track you down? Are you on LinkedIn, Facebook? Are there other ways that people could contact you that we might be able to share?
Yes, I'm on LinkedIn and I am on Facebook. I have a Facebook account, but don't really do much on it.
Okay. So LinkedIn's always a good way to connect, yes. with other social workers and professionals that are out, yeah, doing this kind of work, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So we might put a link to your LinkedIn account at the bottom of our show notes for today. And yeah, just wrapping up, is there any other final words that you'd like to send out with other young social workers or those starting out in the field, or words of encouragement for those types of people?
For people starting out, I would suggest community development and family support type or non-government organisations. They are, that's where I started, and it was a huge learning for me, and I would never encourage new social workers to do something like the Department of Human Services working for federal government, because you become quite siloed in what you do within a department like that, because there's only so much stuff that you can actually do autonomously, like this remote servicing. We work pretty much autonomously out in the community, but if I was working here in Darwin or in a service centre down south, we'd pretty much be doing a very siloed type skill set of work.
So it's beneficial to have some experience out,
yes.
in communities with a non-government organisation, yes. first, to really get to know the land
and
the people and the culture and get some experience, yes. behind you before
and
you
improve
hit
your skill set with there's a lot of boundaries and a lot of policies and legislation that you have to work under in the government situation that can be quite controlling of your skills.
So you have to have a thick skin.
Yes. Because it makes you question a lot of your ethics and things like that when basically, whatever government of the day is the government that you're working for, and then they put out policies and stuff, and you're the one on the ground trying mm. to make this more palatable for the people that are on you know, the coalface of it, who are going to be affected by these policies. And if you've gone there as a new student, I find that it can be quite disempowering for the students or the new graduate social workers.
Right, yeah.
Whereas you learn to become a bit more resilient and you do things and you're encouraged to question things when you're in a non-government organisation.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first social workers that I had, senior social workers that I did supervision with and stuff, they always said to me, you need to challenge stuff. That's why you are a social worker. And that's a core thing, is for you to say why.
Yeah, right.
And you don't sort of get a lot of opportunities with that
right.
in federal government, because you're sort of down the bottom rung somewhere where you're not the person driving policies mm-hmm. and stuff. Mm-hmm. And
well, that sounds like really great advice for young social workers just starting out in this kind of work. Thank you, Alison, for agreeing to meet with me today on this beautiful dry season day. I know that you've probably got plenty of other things you'd rather be doing right now, but I really do appreciate you coming along and sharing your stories and your practice and how that's developed over the years, not just in the Northern Territory, but it started way back in Queensland and even further back when you were growing up in Fiji. So thank you.
Thank you, Lucy. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.